Before we dive into today's discussion, we have a special resource just for you, a free ebook called Does It Make Sense to Believe in God? In today's world where faith is often labelled as outdated or irrational, this ebook takes a fresh look at the evidence for God. It features reflections from years of engaging with some of the world's leading atheists, like Richard Dawkins, and reveals why, after hearing every conceivable argument, our confidence in God's existence is stronger than ever. Download Does It Make Sense to Believe in God today for free at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, let's get started with today's show.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Watt and I'm joined as ever by my dad, John Watt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And we're pleased to say that we've got a guest on the show today. That's Sharon Dirks. Hi, Sharon. How are you today?
Hi, really well, thank you.
For those who've not come across you before, Sharon, do you want to explain a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, well, great to be here on your podcast. Thanks so much for having me on. And I'm a speaker, kind of sometimes guest lecturer, apologist, evangelist, podcaster, and an author. So, I mean, lots of different facets.
And you used to be a neuroscientist, isn't that right, Sharon? So tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so I spent just over a decade in the area of functional MRI, which I arrived at via biochemistry. That was my undergraduate degree. And so I was using functional MRI to look at, first of all, functional MRI, for those that don't know, is a way of looking at brain activity without invading the brain in any way. And that's why MRI is so helpful and useful. Lots of people will have had structural scans and so on. Functional MRI looks at blood flow changes, which is a downstream of what's happening in the brain. And so I was using that in my PhD to look at some methodological factors while functional MRI was at quite an early stage in its development. And then I went to the States and did a postdoc looking at human cocaine abuse, which was a more interesting application of it and quite fascinating. So I really enjoyed that. I came back and did another postdoc in Oxford as well before moving into this area of apologetics and evangelism, giving reasons and responses for why we believe what we do.
And so you were very much involved in discussions about body-mind relationships, weren't you? And you wrote a book about that.
How
did the change from neuroscience into a more directly sort of Christian role? How did that come about and how did you find it?
Yeah, so I became a Christian as an undergraduate, so I arrived at university an agnostic, but it was a number of years after that that I realised that that I might be wired in such a way to be someone that likes to share what I believe with other people and talk about ideas and thoughts. So during this postdoc in the US, I was conducting this research, but alongside that, I was finding myself having all kinds of conversations about the Christian faith with my lab mates, office mates. And I realized that I wasn't equipped. I didn't really know how to respond. I wasn't equipped to do that. So I wanted to get some more training. And I heard about a course that was starting in Oxford. So this was in the early 2000s at that point. And this course at Ocker, which was very much part of Wycliffe Hall in Oxford at that point, was starting. So I applied, had an interview over the phone with Michael Green, who was a very well-known evangelist in the UK. And then I ended up studying for 1 year in evangelism and apologetics and some theology thrown in. And then I returned to brain imaging part-time and then had the opportunity to move more into apologetics. I like to still think of myself as a scientist. It's just that my data is a bit different. I think I still approach it as a scientist in a quite a logical way, but not a cold calculating way.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So let's unpick that a bit more. So approaching Christian data as a scientist, what does that mean? I mean, how do you interpret that?
Well, the thing that really impressed that was really impressed upon me as I was thinking about why I believe what I do was that if something is true, then it will hold water. We can ask the hardest questions that we want of it, and it isn't going to crumble underneath us, which is why we don't need to be afraid to ask the questions that we have about the Christian faith, whether Jesus really did rise from the dead, whether we can trust what we read in the Bible, why God would allow suffering, which is what we'll look at in more detail today. And so in that sense, that we can really press in and ask hard questions and approach it logically. If something is true, it's also livable. And actually, things that are not true, we get to a point where we can no longer live what we believe. And that becomes the hinge point at which you end up asking, well, what default system have I now adopted in the way that I actually live? And so I think these are kind of reasonable, rational ways of thinking about a worldview and why we should consider the Christian worldview above the other options.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think I can see how for myself as a young scientist and a clinician, I was going on a similar journey. And you know, when I was in my 20s and coming to a similar position of a kind of robust confidence in the reliability and the profundity of Christian truth, and the fact that you could jump up and down on the floorboards, you didn't need to be tiptoeing around in case it couldn't sustain you.
Yes.
And so it's interesting, isn't it? And for me, that was a great sense of liberation. Instead of being cautious about, this might be a bit dangerous and so on, there was a sign of robust confidence.
Yeah,
is that your feeling?
Yes. And actually very sad when I hear stories of people that say they weren't able to ask their questions and have walked away from their, you know, the Christian faith because they had questions and they couldn't find convincing answers or any form of answer because you just don't question it. And so I think it's very important for the intergenerational continuation of the Christian faith as well, especially in a very sceptical age.
Do you think there are lots of believers who still exist in that place of kind of uncertainty and fear and think, well, I have to just take this on faith and I'm not supposed to like go looking for hard evidence. I'm supposed to just take what I've been told and not probe too deeply.
I think there are. And actually, this is where we need to have a right definition of what faith actually is. You know, one of the things that I say a lot, which I think I've taken from others that I've received teaching from, like, you know, John Lennox, Alistair McGrath and so on, is that actually everyone has faith in something. And we exercise that faith, not in a blind way, but always on the basis of the evidence to support it. If we take the face value meaning of faith to be trust in something or someone, then you know, we have a high level of trust in things that have shown themselves trustworthy, or for example, in people. You know, we have a high level of trust in people that have a proven track record of being reliable and dependable, and a low level of faith in people that have let us down. But either way, the level of faith is dependent on the evidence to support it. It's not a blind thing. And it's the same with faith in Jesus Christ. When people put their faith in him, it wasn't an unthinking leap into the dark. It was actually a response to the evidence of this living, breathing human being that was unlike anyone else that had ever lived and walked the earth. And of course, we don't have a living, breathing Jesus in front of us, but we do have a lot of evidence that we can look at in manuscripts that can be trusted, and the experiential evidence of what God is doing around the world today, the stories of people that have been changed by him and transformed and so on. So faith is not a blind thing. It is evidence-based. You don't have to throw your brain out of the window to consider Jesus.
And we wanted to dive in particularly on one part of your ministry, your apologetics kind of ministry, which is your most recent book, Broken Planet: If There's a God, Then Why Are There Natural Disasters and Diseases? This will be a question I'm sure that lots of people would be familiar with, lots of people have been asked or have asked it themselves. Why did you decide to write on this in particular? Was it coming up time and time again when you did events and kind of engage with non-Christians?
Yes. Well, I have. So in 2013, I published a book on suffering, which was more focused on personal suffering, and that was called Why. And I wove in sort of stories of people's personal suffering with some apologetic attempts to respond to the hard questions. But alongside that, the question of natural disasters, in a way, presented a completely it's sort of a different angle on the whole question. When Christians often respond to the question of suffering, they often give what's known as a free will defense, saying that, you know, humans have been given freedom to live how they want to, and that's kind of a dignifying thing that God has given. But the flip side of that is they're going to be cruel to each other as well as noble in their actions. And so that partly, you know, partly explains the suffering that we see in the world. And it does account for quite a lot of it. But of course, earthquakes, tsunamis, hurricanes, wildfires, and indeed pandemics don't seem to fit into that category. In fact, they seem to refer to a world that God's seemingly made, you know. And so why has God made the natural world? Why has he made our biology to be the way that it is? And so that in a sense, that's kind of the hardest kernel of the question of suffering, that a free will defense is not sufficient to respond to. So I wanted to tackle that. And there are so many different kinds of natural disaster as well, and they require slightly different responses.
So you don't think there's a kind of single hermeneutic, to use a posh phrase, that could just you could layer onto every volcano, earthquake, tsunami, cancer, everything else that is not caused by human action? You think you need a more kind of subtle response to work through each individual form of kind of natural suffering, if we could use that language?
I think there are some common themes through some of them. And then there are some challenges further down the line. So, I mean, there are common themes. There are some things that we can say, there are frameworks, but there isn't like a one sentence response to this. That's why I wrote a book. but there are some things we can say. But of course, as always, it's always within the context of this is mysterious as well. There's a lot that we don't understand, and actually the Bible's quite clear that we're never going to be able to understand everything that happens. In fact, there's much that we will never understand this side of eternity. So yeah, I try to unpick those bit by bit.
One of the discussions that I've frequently had with other scientists, including scientists who are Christians, is about genetic abnormalities and mutations and so on. And the argument goes from some scientists is that genetic mutations are an essential feature of evolution. Without genetic mutations, there would be no evolution. And therefore, they can be seen as actually part of God's good design from a Christian point of view, that this is the way he has designed the world. But my perspective as a paediatrician, caring for many babies and children whose lives have been completely devastated by genetic mutation, you know, I find that very difficult to say. This is the way God designed it. That this, you know, what's your reflections on that?
Yeah. So. I agree, essentially, but and just to kind of lay a little bit out of what I say ahead of that time. So one of the things that I sort of say is that a lot of the mechanisms behind, say, earthquakes, volcanoes, actually have a life-giving role in the kind of way that the world is. That's one thing. And so, you know, the fact that we get caught up in these things is kind of the flip side of being in a world that God has made to be life-giving and life-sustaining, which is, you know, one thing we could say. The other side of it being that there's also a human factor, that human beings have an ability to make a disaster worse by kind of failure to intervene, failure to kind of prevent or warn or whatever. But there are, as you say, things in our world that seem to have no apparent life-giving function and no apparent human factor either. I mean, I guess we could argue that some genetic diseases might have a location back in, you know, environmental matters, but not in every case. And there seem to be some things for which there seems to be no apparent good that is coming from it. And that's where I say that, you know, we're not just dealing with nature, we're not just dealing with human beings and how they behave. There's also a deeper cause, there's a deeper brokenness that's sort of built in to the natural world, not from the beginning, but somewhere quite close to the beginning. You know, there was there's a level of brokenness. I would say that is spiritual in its root. That there's a spirit, there's a brokenness in nature because of sort of spiritual brokenness. And this is where it becomes very hard to talk about evil and suffering, where we're just defending God and just defending why he would make the world the way that he has. I think that it becomes very hard to talk about it without acknowledging that there is such a thing as transcendent evil as well. And I think if we leave that out of the equation, the more I've thought about this, I just don't think we can. And that's why I named my book Broken Planet, that there we actually do live on a broken planet, that the big picture narrative is that God is good and he can't create anything that is outside of who he is intrinsically. And he is the ultimate definition of good and has created a good world. But that world also had the potential for evil. And somehow that potential became actual. And that introduced a brokenness into human behavior, human biology, and also the natural world itself. Now, how that happened, exactly when and where, you know, I think there are different theodicies, there are different ways of looking at that. But I don't see any other way of making sense of it, that there is just something that's broken. There is something wrong with the way the world is. It's not supposed to be this way, which is why we react that way to it. We don't just blindly say, oh, well, this is just the flip side of living on a planet that's built to sustain life and human beings do what they do. No, we get angry. We call them disasters. We fight cancer. You know, we battle mental health. We don't just blithely say this is just the way the world is and resign to it. We get angry. There's something wrong. And so that makes sense if God exists, but it not so much if he doesn't. Because evil also exists and the world is broken.
It's when I was growing up, I was often kind of told or taught, I suppose, that when humans fell in the, you know, in the garden, however you understand that passage of Genesis as a literal historical thing or as a kind of richer spiritual truth, that humans at some point made the decision to turn their backs on God. But that had a kind of fracturing effect, not just on human hearts, but also on the created order around them, and that was the moment at which our actions didn't just mean that kind of subsequent generations of humans have continually chosen to sin and chosen to introduce harm and cruelty and suffering to each other, but it also kind of fractured the created order, and the good world that God had made then started going wrong in various ways, you know, cancer, yeah, mutations, natural disasters. Yeah. Is that a view that you would share, or is that a bit simplistic?
So that's definitely one of the question then raises, well, how did it become broken? And you highlight probably what would be considered one of the mainstream views held, you know, in kind of traditional Christianity, where it is kind of located in a human fall. Now, I think that that is, you know, definitely part of it. But then someone might raise the question, well, what about the fact that if you take an old earth view, and I realize that this is then tied up with the view that you hold on the age of the earth and so on. I take an old earth view, then we have the question of, well, why were there earthquakes and volcanic eruptions taking place long before human beings ever entered the scene? Mm-hmm. And there we have to kind of look at other possible theodicies as well. And I actually, in my thinking and research, have been very helped by a view that someone like Michael Lloyd, principal of Wycliffe Hall, puts forward, that that actually, you know, in God didn't just create the earth occupied by human beings that were given free will. He also created the heavens, which are occupied by angelic beings who were also given free will. And actually, it's a, you know, part of traditional Christian thinking that the origins of evil lie in the fall of one of those or some of those angelic beings. And what we see as we read Genesis is that the serpent is in the garden already. He's simply there. And the author doesn't say how long he's been there, what he's been up to. And so it's not outside the bounds of possibility that nature became broken before humans. I think that's within the scope of what we see in scripture. And I feel like it helps me make more sense of, you know, the kind of the bigger picture of it all. And then, of course, human beings were enticed by evil and introduced another level of brokenness as well. Of course, people that take that view have to wrestle with, well, why would God allow evil to be part of a process that was also being described as good in the Genesis account? So every view has its challenges. I don't think it's either or with this. In fact, any of the arguments that I put forward in Broken Planet, I don't think it's an either or. It's not a choose this or this. It all sort of together maybe helps us.
Different pieces of the jigsaw that kind of come together.
Yeah.
I suppose one response, as you kind of hinted at, is people might then say, well, why on earth would a good God create a serpent or create an angelic being that he knew had the capacity to kind of fall and become a demonic force?
Yeah.
Did God create the devil? I suppose so. Was the devil always evil?
He didn't create the devil. He can't create evil. Because God is good. He created good beings, but he dignified them with the good of free will.
Right.
Freedom to make meaningful choices in the heavens and the earth. And it's in the misuse, the exercise of that free will, that we then have the introduction of corruption, evil.
So a similar process for kind of spiritual beings has happened for humans, created good, but given free will. And some of them chose to use that free will to do evil.
I think that's where I'm coming from on it. That there may be other viewpoints out there. This is mysterious. It's not something that's talked about a lot in the Bible either. And so we're trying to piece it together. What we know for sure is that there is evil on earth right now.
Absolutely. You know?
And some people have come closer to it than others, and actually feel like they have encountered, they could, you know, almost sense the presence of great evil in, you know, some of the horrific instances that we've seen in history.
Hmm.
It's a fascinating topic, and it is interesting just to step back a bit, because I'm increasingly convinced this is a really important discussion. The nature of evil, the way that evil operates in the world today. And yet it's interesting, isn't it, that in the Christian circles in which we tend to move, there's so much positivity about the goodness of God and blessing and healing. And it's almost like, I mean, when did you hear a sort of detailed biblical teaching about evil and about the reality of evil and the nature of evil and how to combat evil and so on. It's although I'm sure our church leaders would pay lip service to the fact that they take an orthodox view about personal evil and so on, I wonder, have we been very infected by American sort of positivity, can do, you know, let's be optimistic, let's be positive, whereas I think wrestling with the reality of evil, with as you say, you know, and the fact that some people's lives can become completely trapped by evil, and of course, you know, you only have to look at your news feed to see sort of catastrophic evil around the world. So why is it that we don't wrestle more with this?
I don't know. We sort of have a dichotomy, don't we, in the sense that there's almost an obsession with it in some areas of society. I mean, I don't really want to so much I'm promoting, but there's a huge fascination with it and with some aspects of kind of witchcraft and so on social media, and actually astonishing numbers of kind of subscriptions to various channels, and in Hollywood there's a fascination with it as well, and the imagination runs riot there. But then in the skeptical West, you know, it's a little bit over the top. It's a bit kind of taking things too far. And C.S. Lewis's words, you know, still ring true, that, you know, that actually if there is such a thing as Satan, he's happy with either a materialist or a magician, you know, someone that either denies him entirely or kind of follows him very acutely. I think we see both of those at play. And of course, a lot of our work has been kind of responding to materialism. But I think that's changing. And I think partly it is because of the level of suffering that people are seeing, possibly because of their involvement in some forms of kind of worship of this dimension. And they're realizing that materialism is not enough to explain their experiences and their suffering.
And there are certainly streams of Christianity which are very exercised by things like spiritual warfare. You know, I'm thinking of sometimes called the New Apostolic Reformation, kind of neo-Pentecostal movements, which are kind of growing in some parts of the world, including in the West and the States, where there's a real sense that the Christian is in a daily battle against kind of malevolent spiritual forces. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the kind of background I grew up in was much more about sin is about the human heart and is about people. And the problem of evil is that fact that we are evil and we have turned our backs on God. And there's this kind of central focus on personal redemption through the cross. Yeah. And I think almost a kind of squeamishness or a slight embarrassment about some of the stuff the Bible talks about, angels and demons, and which, you know, in the Gospels is a massive, massive feature of Jesus's ministry, as we know. And yet we're all kind of slightly shy away from it. I think it feels a bit superstitious, a bit almost kind of like proto-modern, a bit kind of pre, you know, that's what they had in the olden days. But us kind of intellectual post-enlightenment, post-reformation, rational Christians know that we need to just focus on our own relationship and our own hearts. Does any of that ring true for you?
It totally rings true. And I think the thing we need to recapture, especially in the West, is we have a supernatural faith. Like if you go through the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, everything in there cannot exist in the natural. It is all supernatural. Like Jesus could never have risen from the dead in the natural. That is not possible. Material explanations cannot capture it. His ascension to heaven, not possible in the natural. The incarnation, not possible in the natural. The new heaven and the new earth, not possible in the natural. Like it's all supernatural, all the important bits. And we need to recapture this. And people are losing interest in materialism. We need to offer them, as Tom Holland, or not Spider-Man, the rest of the says, to not shy away from the weirdness of it. It's weird. That's what people are looking for, you know? And that's what we need to not be afraid of and not ashamed of. And I think that, you know, even just go back to Genesis 3, you know, that... you don't even need to get into angels and demons, that these early humans were tempted before they made the decision. They were tempted by evil. There was external evil, and then they chose. And so both of those things are at play. Yes, it's the human heart, but there's a battle, as you say, that's kind of outside of us and at work within us.
Yeah, it's a fascinating topic. And I think one of the things that interests me is that, as you say, Tim, there is this Pentecostal, charismatic, sometimes fascination with the battle against evil. But when I hear and have come across this kind of narrative, it often is a vision of kind of siege warfare, like Ukraine. You know, you've got the serried ranks of good on one side, you've got the serried ranks of evil, and we need more power. Because we've got an intrusion over here, and we need to fight back, and so on. And it's this massive sort of siege warfare mentality. And yet, when you go to the scriptures, there's very little of that. It's much more like a sort of deception, propaganda, manipulation, a sort of a mole, a double agent who's masquerading. It's a much more sophisticated, subtle, a complex kind of attack. And Genesis 3 is a classic example, isn't it? I mean, I think was it Tim Keller who said that when Satan decided to attack Eve, he didn't use a hammer, he used an idea. And it's that sort of subtlety of
and it's twisting kind of God's words against him, which is the same tactic the devil uses when he tempts Jesus in the wilderness. You know, did God really say, or is it not written? And as you say, it's a very subtle, insidious, very personal kind of evil in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're excited to announce the launch of a brand new podcast from Premier Insight called The Bible Explored with Rico Tice, featuring Rico Tice, a renowned British preacher and apologist. The Bible Explored with Rico Tice offers practical guidance for living out the eternal truth of God's word in everyday life. It will inspire and equip you to boldly share the gospel, even in life's toughest situations. To continue creating content and resources like this, we rely on the generosity of listeners like you. Your support is vital to keep Premier Insight strong and ensure programs like The Bible Explored with Rico Tice can reach more people to equip a generation of Christians to live out their faith with clarity, conviction, and confidence. Simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Moving back to the kind of natural disaster for a second, it's really important, obviously, to think through the kind of causes and where does natural evil come from. But when you're actually sitting there with someone who says, I could never believe in God because why would a God allow cancer to kind of eat away and take the life of my loved one, how do we as Christians respond in that moment? I suspect going straight to kind of intense philosophical biblical breakdowns of Genesis 3 immediately might not be the best first step in that conversation.
No. So how I would tackle that, intellectually forming an argument, and how I would tackle it pastorally are two really different things. I mean, if the person in that moment is asking you a question, it's actually really hard to know, like, what the right thing is to say. Mm. And I mean, I could obviously unpack at some point, if God doesn't exist, what are your options? Your options are, this is just the way the world is, grin it, you know, chin up and off we go. But that's not helpful in the slightest. And I wouldn't say that in this situation. Actually, where I would go to is that we just can't get away from the fact that at the heart of the Christian faith is a God on a cross, that actually that that Jesus Christ knows what it is to suffer. And he has not left us alone in our suffering. You know, the basis for humanitarian aid, for medical help, is the incarnation of the God who doesn't just send us information on how to cope with tragedy and grief, but actually comes to be with us in person. And that is the basis of why we would go to others as well. So part of my response would be to be present with them. Sometimes words are not necessary. So sometimes words are not even adequate. And we see that in Job, which is incidentally the oldest book chronologically in the Bible, which does face head on the spiritual battle.
It's a very real personal Satan involved there, isn't there?
Yeah. And his friends are just ridiculous, you know. The thing they do well is say nothing for a week. It's when they start to open their mouths that it all goes wrong. And sometimes words are not enough, and actually being incarnationally present with somebody is what is needed. But we have a God who knows what it is to suffer. So we're carrying people to Jesus. We don't have what it takes to give them what they need, but we are told that he is the God of all comfort, the God of all compassion, who comforts us in all of our troubles, so that we can comfort others. And so as people that have experienced the comfort of God in our own tragedy, we can carry other people to that same God for him to comfort them.
There's something really intriguing and yet also infuriating about the book of Job, because, as you say, it's the book of the Bible which most directly kind of tackles this question of suffering, and yet it doesn't really resolve with any kind of neat solution or answer. As far as I can tell, as a very much non-theologian, it's kind of God saying, you know, you weren't there when I made the world. It's not really for you to know, Job. So it kind of knocks down some supposed answers, but doesn't really offer one in its place. Do you use the book of Job much in your apologetics? Is it a useful kind of foundation, or is it quite mysterious?
Yes, I do use it. And the thing that's so interesting is that, I think one of the main points of the book is that Job is not suffering because of God is punishing him. I mean, he suffers greatly, but it's not punishment. And actually, we're really clear on that, because we have a vantage point on his situation that he never has. But actually, it's because he's upright before God that he's suffering. And actually, one of the questions that a skeptic might often ask, or even someone within the Christian faith, we often think, is God punishing me? Is there something I've done to deserve this? And actually, very often it's the opposite. And this is where the battle is so important, that we're caught up in a battle that is bigger than us, that is very real. And no, it's not punishment. It's actually that good and evil are, the battle is raging around us. And Job doesn't get answers. He doesn't get reasons. He gets God. And I think, oh, really, you just plowed him with questions for this poor man has lost everything, you know, and almost his own life, his health. But I think we have to we can't picture the sense in which God was firstly not impressed with his friends and tells them that they have not represented him well. But secondly, the sense in which Job was surely being held in God's presence while he questions him. It's not this cold, calculating, answer all these questions right now for me. It's actually a kind of a gentle kind of reminding him of the bigger picture and of who God is, and then restoring him as well. I think it's a really helpful book. He doesn't get reasons, he gets relationship, and I think that's ultimately where the buck stops. You know, we will never know why some things have happened. And we have the choice of whether we'll go through it without God or with him.
And I think this idea of do people suffer because God is punishing them feels very alien and almost offensive to us modern ears. But it was kind of taken for granted, wasn't it, in most, if not all, of the ancient world. And you can see it running through even to the New Testament. You know, Jesus addresses it in Luke about the Tower of Siloam. Yeah. You know, it talks about people who died when a tower collapses in Jerusalem, and were they more guilty than others who lived that day? And he kind of knocks down that argument and says, no, but unless you repent, you too will perish.
Right. So
it's clearly a very live issue for that culture.
Yeah.
Even if it's not for us.
Absolutely. And, when there's been another natural disaster, someone tries to make a spiritual pronouncement as to why this has happened, and it being a form of judgment of God. But I think you're right to highlight Jesus' words that actually he said, he doesn't say that at all. He actually says, look, rather than being pronouncing some external diagnosis, actually, when we see a disaster, a large scale disaster, it should cause us to look inwards to assess where are we with God, and actually forwards to the fact that this is not an act of judgment, but there will be a justice in the future for all people. And it causes us to assess our choices, our life, where are we with God? What have we done with the offer of Jesus Christ of eternal life and a transformed life with him? Are we going to say yes to that or no to that? That has consequences in the future from a very just God who will bring about ultimate justice. And so, yeah, when we hear of a natural disaster, that's the kind of thing it ought to evoke in us rather than a pronouncement of where other people are at.
I think it's really interesting just to take a long-term historical perspective on this, because I think it's probably true, isn't it, Sharon, that if you were to ask what is the commonest reason that people say why I can't believe in a God of love, or I can't believe that God exists, they would say, well, just look at the suffering in the world. No God could allow that, you know. And yet, if you look in the long term over history, that is actually a relatively new idea. I think many people trace it to the Enlightenment, and in particular, there was the Lisbon earthquake, which I've just looked up and was in 1755, a terrible earthquake which led to massive loss of life. And Voltaire wrote a famous poem basically saying how could, against the idea that God always works things together for good and this is the best possible world. And many people think that that was the start of this idea, that it is simply impossible for God to exist given the amount of suffering there is in the world. But isn't it interesting that for sort of 1700 years, people suffered terribly through all the things that happened, terrible tragedies of one kind or another, including the plagues and the, and yet they didn't see it as a reason to say God doesn't exist. They said, how could, why are you doing this, God? But they didn't say, therefore God doesn't exist. So what changed?
Well, great question. And I wonder if that we're reaching a point at which kind of Lisbon was a particularly, catastrophic example of multiple disasters. They had this extremely severe earthquake, then they had a tsunami, and then the flooding, people died as the city was flooded in the aftermath of this tsunami. And we're talking like gaping holes in the streets, people being kind of just disappearing. And it was just, apocalyptic in its impact. And so maybe there's something about the scale that it was the scale of something like that hadn't happened for many centuries, and it arrived at a time when the transfer of information around the world suddenly was more possible, that even if that had happened in the past, not many people would get to hear about it. And so then ideas can kind of spread and bring influence and so on. So I wonder if those things might have been part of it, and of course it was also in response to the idea from Leibniz that this is the best of all possible worlds, and that God couldn't have created a better world. Well, that on its own probably isn't sufficient to make sense of Lisbon. And an answer like that in the face of awful tragedy is obviously not going to be enough. Of course, there are other things we could say, but Leibniz didn't say those necessarily, and Voltaire didn't refer to them either. So
I wonder, this is speculative, but is there something about the Enlightenment comes as the Industrial Revolution is kicking off and human beings are kind of accelerating in this idea of progress? We're developing a kind of mastery and control of the natural world that we've never had before. Populations are booming. We're starting to live longer, healthier lives. You know, because one level it's a paradox, isn't it, that for 1700 years, people were much more likely to die in violence or from illness or in natural disasters than they are today. And yet they didn't see this immense orders of magnitude greater suffering that they encountered on average as a reason to doubt God's existence. And I wonder, actually, it's because as we moved into the kind of modern industrialized age in which we could kind of kid ourselves that we had this mastery and control over the natural world, it became and that we were living longer and we were better nourished and we weren't dying in childbirth as often, it became more offensive to us the ways in which we still suffered and we could not stop our loved ones from dying from diseases or in natural disasters. And so whereas there was a sense of almost like inevitability and helplessness in an earlier pre-industrial age, because they just, it was nonsense to believe that, of course, you know, they called these things acts of God, right? Because they were just sudden. An earthquake would happen, people would die, nothing you could do. Whereas now we say, well, actually, there's loads you could do. You could build, you know, those same earthquakes happen today and no one dies because we build buildings that don't fall down and all that kind of stuff. So there's something about, as human beings accrue more power, we are more offended or more outraged by the demonstrations that what we cannot prevent or stop.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's definitely part of it.
There's an arrogance, though, isn't there, as well, about the modern age? That, in other words, I simply cannot see how an omniscient, omnipotent being could possibly allow this. I mean, it simply goes against my understanding of good and evil, and therefore, by definition, my understanding must outweigh. It's simply impossible that anybody could have a different perspective. It's kind of, you know, it's an extraordinary level of arrogance, isn't it? That I, with my little puny understanding, can just refuse to believe that any omniscient, omnipotent being could possibly do it any other way.
Yes, I guess it presupposes allowing the possibility of an omnipotent being as well to exist. And people may have already made a decision about that on very different grounds as well. And people hold their beliefs for all kinds of reasons, and probably not merely just intellectual ones. I think there are lots of kind of deeply emotional reasons why people believe what they do, and sometimes they come out in very logical sounding arguments, but they have a very different root.
Once framed, I remember, in my we were studying this when I was doing my GCSEs, so kind of 15-16 at school, and someone, they even said, you know, it's a kind of like a mathematical formula. You know, you have a triangle, and you have the existence of suffering, you have an all-powerful God, and you have a God who is good. And the kind of theory is that, you know, no, you can take two of those things together, but all three can't coexist. And it was almost framed as a kind of neat equation, almost like mathematical, rather than actually a deeply mysterious piece of philosophy and theology.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, maybe just to say something to that, I think one of the things that we need to say is that God has made a universe that is life-giving, life-permitting, and some of the mechanisms that are involved in some of these are life-giving mechanisms as well. And it is sort of the you know, part and parcel of living in a world with these mechanisms for some things. And actually, also, he's created a world that has, on the whole, stable laws of nature, which means we can live meaningfully within that universe. So like, you know, if we wanted to pick up a glass of water and drink it, we know that we can exert a force on the glass, we can overcome gravitational force temporarily and drink the water. But if the glass kind of suddenly started flying around the room and we couldn't pick it up and the laws of nature were sort of constantly changing or then we actually wouldn't be able to make any sort of decision to drink the water, and our ability to live meaningfully goes. And so somewhere in the mix, not that this is all of the answer, but it's part of what we're wanting to say, is that God has built into the universe that we have the goods of a life permitting universe in which human beings can live meaningfully and exercise choice, and that involves their interaction with the laws of nature as well. And once you become committed to those goods, perhaps certain other outcomes then become more likely in terms of what is happening, what's possible in the world. So this is not, obviously, no one thing that we say here is a whole answer, but it is important to at least make the point.
Yeah, I've sometimes thought about the contrast between living in a world which was like a children's adventure playground, you know, where you could sort of do whatever you like in your bouncy castle and basically you can't hurt yourself, you know, whatever you try, whenever you try to do do something damaging, you know, your hammer just turns into rubber, and you're constantly protected from harm.
Yeah.
But it's a kid's playground. It's and it's, of course, the wise people who've designed it have designed it so that you can't hurt yourself. But instead, God gave us the privilege of not living in an adventure playground, but in a real world.
Yeah.
Where actually, if we do bad things or stupid things or irrational things, or consequences happen, and we're not protected from that. And actually, that's about like being treated like a grown up rather than being treated like a child. And God gave us that ultimate privilege of treating us as grown ups.
Yeah. And also, it was a world that He Himself was willing to enter.
Mm,
so exactly. The kind that He created was not one that He remained absent from. And that's a really important part of it, that we've not been left on our own in this world. For whatever reason, this particular kind of world is here. It's one that God Himself has occupied.
Yeah, I do think that is absolutely so, so central to the whole. And it is the uniqueness of Christianity, isn't it? It's only Christianity has this ultimate weird thing of the incarnation, that the God of the cosmos, the God who upholds the entire cosmos, enters into it and becomes, well, as C.S. Lewis said, an actor on the in his own play. He participates. It's that weird and wonderful thing that he becomes one of us.
Yeah.
And potentially you could almost reframe the problem of suffering as a different encapsulation of an age-old objection. You know, the ancients, when they heard about Christianity, they rebelled against the idea that a god could come in and become part of the mess in the physical world. And that was, you know, to a lot of the kind of Greek philosophers, was kind of deeply ridiculous or offensive. And today we rebel against the incarnation in a different way. We say, well, how could God, you know, permit this to be so messy? And that's another kind of facet on the incarnation. We're just kind of rejecting a slightly different perspective on the same fundamental weirdness, uniqueness, outrageousness of the Christian gospel.
Yeah. We're certainly, you know, the one thing that we can say for sure is we're not in sharing the person of Jesus and inviting someone to consider him. We're not saying, here's just a bit of icing on the kind of cake that you already have. Here's just something to make your life a little bit better. We're actually offering something that is completely otherworldly, and rightly so. That is what the Christian faith is.
And which you couldn't make it up, can you? You know, because, of course, the alternative explanation about Christianity is that it was invented by a whole load of quite clever sort of people around the turn of the, you know, the millennium. And they just came up with this weird idea, and it was quite clever. But, you know, who really, you know, what human mind could really come up with that, the incarnation and the cross and the resurrection? I mean, this was none of them were expecting it. None of the prophets of the Old Testament, nobody. This was a completely and utterly inconceivable twist in the plot.
And they didn't believe it.
No, they didn't. They couldn't believe it.
And that is a pointer to the authenticity of what you're reading as well, because the authors, the participants are not portrayed in a very good light. That if you were trying to write something after the fact to make people look good and make up a story, you wouldn't put those levels of details in of people that look really stupid.
Yeah, this just reminded me briefly of when I was at university, I somehow got involved in a debate that was put on between the Christian Union and the Atheist Society about, you know, is God real, or maybe it was did Jesus rise from the dead? And one of the atheist speakers made the point that, well, this is clearly what's most likely is that the disciples, Jesus died and didn't, and they basically wrote what the ending they wanted to happen into the story. And I said, have you actually read any of Acts? Because it doesn't portray the disciples in a particularly good light. In fact, it's the most kind of devastating character assassination of people like Peter and others. If they were writing, you know, there is no world in which they would say this, we are going to invent out of whole cloth a series of episodes in which we are revealed to be totally lacking in faith, to be callous, foolish, it doesn't make sense.
My husband became a Christian as an undergrad as well. I didn't know him at the time, we were at different unis, but the thing that really convinced him was the change in the disciples, and the idea that, you know, why would you die for a lie? Why would they all went on to be martyred for their belief that they believed they had seen the risen Jesus. They'd lived their lives as though he was risen from the dead. If actually deep down you knew that you just made that up as a lie, would you really be willing to sort of give your life, not just in sharing it, but then ultimately die for it? Yeah. Why would you die for a lie? That was what convinced him ultimately. Mm.
Just before we finish, can I just ask a slightly broader question about kind of apologetics? It's interesting you said both you and your husband both didn't grow up in a kind of church family, but became believers as adults at university. You know, I mentioned I was part of the Christian Union. It was a kind of, we put on lots of evangelistic events with what felt like very little impact. And I sometimes wonder, is the kind of apologetics framework, here are some reasons to believe, here are some solutions to your problems, is that a 20th century approach to evangelism? Are people today, non-Christians today in the West, are they really asking the same questions about, can we trust the Bible? Did Jesus rise from the dead? Are those actually their barriers to faith? Do you find that, you know, people are really meaningfully asking the questions that apologists like yourself are answering?
Yes, I think the questions have, some of them have changed. So I've been doing this for a couple of decades, and I would say that the form of question is a bit different now. For people that... I think we're now seeing a whole generation of people that have been raised with no contact with the Christian faith. In some ways, that's amazing because you have a blank slate and you don't need to undo necessarily anything that they've been taught. That. And so in some ways, there's a huge interest. I think we're seeing I think it's easier to do evangelism on university campuses now than it was 10 years ago. I think there's more interest, there's more hunger. I think the questions have changed. So things like, has science disproved God? Maybe you could still do that. But the question like, can science answer all of our questions, is maybe a more helpful way to address it. Well, you're not even assuming God, actually. I mean, obviously, we know that we'll bring that in to the talk, but the question is a step further back, maybe sort of more bigger picture. There's a lot of moral outrage. So objections to God, to suffering, to the Bible, actually are kind of really moral questions. Questions of kind of genocide in the Old Testament and so on, and that's interesting in a world of sort of, you know, cancel culture. So I think we're seeing some questions are similar, but some questions have changed. But there is actually, I think, a growth in people's interest and in Christian things, particularly as they're seeing their kind of perhaps some previous way of looking at the world isn't necessarily working for them.
I really notice a difference between, and I think perhaps it's always been there, between the undergraduate kind of questions and the sort of questions which people are asking once they're into a professional career or some other kind of postgraduate study or whatever, which is often seems to be much more around issues of suffering, but it's often personal suffering.
Yeah.
Watching parents, children, siblings, others, friends suffer, or else it's meaning. I mean, what's the point of it all?
Yes.
Less than the traditional things about.
Right.
But I think that just reflects a sort of changing situation, don't you? As a student, you are in this wonderful melting pot when it is possible, at least in theory, to discuss the big ideas. And whereas I think once you're into the nitty-gritty of life and creating families and working out what you're going to do with your life, it's a rather different game.
Yeah.
You sometimes hear the kind of objection to traditional apologetics and evangelism that, you know, people these days, they aren't asking, you know, why do you believe what you believe, but they want to see what difference it makes in your life. And so a more effective form of evangelism is not kind of trying to substantiate Christian faith, but actually kind of relational, personal evangelism, which you say, this is the difference that following Jesus makes to my life, and you could have this as well. And then only secondarily do we get to, and this is why we believe what we believe, and this is what the Bible says is true, etc.
Yeah.
Do you have any truck with that, or do you think that can operate in tandem with kind of more traditional proclamational evangelism?
I think it can work in tandem. I think we definitely need proclamation, just in the right way and with the right tone. But it reminds me of, so I recently was debating somebody, and the final question, so it was on science and God, the final question was, do you think bad religion or bad science is the more dangerous? Which of the two do you think?
That's a great question.
Yeah. It is a great question. I'd be interested to know your response, John. But it highlights, before I won't, unless you want to know what I said, but anyway, it highlights that actually bad religion is at the forefront of a lot of people's minds, and Christians, you know, I think a few decades ago we'd sort of say, oh no, Christians are great but religion is bad, and you need to just see that Jesus is not a religious leader, he's actually different to that. But I think now we're needing to say, no, Christians have actually made a bit of a mess of it, and there's a lot of apologizing to do. There are people that we're talking to that have been hurt by the church, have been hurt by Christians, have been disillusioned by Christian leaders. And so that's a slightly new context that we're in this particular moment, that we need to eat quite a lot of humble pie and actually listen to people and make sure they feel really heard in that. And that's definitely part of it. And that happens pastorally, one-on-one. It happens from a platform as well. And then also, yeah, the life that we lead around our friends and course students and co-workers obviously speaks powerfully as well.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I mean, certainly one of the things that I've learned time and time again in my work as a clinician, trying to help people come to terms with tragedy and so on, is that bad religion is worse than no religion at all. You know, that I've seen so many examples of bad religion, including, you know, wonky Christian, so-called Christian understanding. God is punishing me. The reason my baby's got this problem is because, et cetera, why? All these kind of things that... And then bad religion can have a terrible, devastating effect. I suppose it's not surprising, is it? Because once you're dealing with issues of faith, you're dealing with these ultimate realities of a meaning and purpose that of my life, the way I make sense of everything that happens. And when that is bad and distorted and twisted, it's such a powerful force that it leads to terrible, terrible outcomes. Whereas science is a bit more neutral, isn't it? It doesn't quite have that kind of emotional intensity.
No, but they could wipe out the planet, though.
Well, so. Quite.
Yeah. Yeah, depending where you stand on the whole lab leak hypothesis, there's potential for real harm from bad science. But let's not go there right now. I guess my final reflection on what you were saying, Sharon, is that, you know, you is almost like, if we want to do good evangelism right now, we have to do a bit of ground clearing first. And that might mean, you know, acknowledging the ways in which the church has got things badly wrong and has drifted away from you know, true faith and from the person of Christ. But actually, that posture of humility is not just a kind of strategic necessity if you want to have a hearing, but it's actually a really healthy way to do all evangelism.
Right.
Rather than, it's been true forever. But I think, I worry that sometimes coming out of the kind of tail end of Christendom, a lot of evangelism was done from the sense of, well, you know, you used to be a Christian, your parents were, so you just need to come back to where you should be, back in the church where it always was. We've got all the answers. And actually approaching it as you have to now with, well, you and your parents and your parents' parents have never gone to church and have no Christian faith. We're kind of starting from a blank slate, like you said. It's actually healthy to say, look, here are some answers that I found in this ancient 2,000-year-old religion. Here is the life I found in following this person called Jesus. Can we talk about it and address some of it as two people on a level playing field, rather than from a position of power, authority, hectoring, lecturing, and that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. Was it Becky Pippert that said it's evangelism is one beggar showing another beggar where to find bread?
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that's probably a healthy approach.
100%. Well, we've reached over an hour, so we should probably let you get on with the rest of your day, Sharon. It's been a really fascinating conversation. Thanks so much for coming on. If people want to find out a bit more about you and or particularly get a hold of the book Broken Planet, where should they go?
Well, you could start with my website, which is dirckx.org, dirckx.org. But it's also available on Amazon and from IVP, all the usual places. And then I've got Am I Just My Brain and Why should be there as well.
Brilliant. Well, yeah, strongly recommend go and have a look at some of Sharon's books and writings. Really, really useful resources there for lots of interesting questions. Thanks, everyone, for listening as well. We'd love to hear your own thoughts and reflections on some of the things we've been talking about. You can get in touch with us by emailing molad@premier.org.uk. As always, there's lots of good stuff on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. And if you want to find some of my own writing and journalism, that's tswyatt.com. But we'll be back next week with another episode. And until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.